From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Dr. Antonio DiMasio, the author of Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain.
Tech Nation is underwritten in part by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
We humans know we are conscious. Anyone listening to this program is conscious that he or she is listening to this interview. Yet we slip in and out of consciousness all the time, every day. Dr. Antonio DiMasio is the director of the Brain and Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California.
Absolutely. It's quite normal when you go to sleep, whether you take a nap or go for your night sleep, you just turn it off. And you turn it off naturally and automatically, and you're not worried about it. You just surrender consciousness. Then there it goes until you wake up and you return to that full normal consciousness. Of course, in between, if you have dreams, you do come back to a state of consciousness which is not your typical normal consciousness, but it is a state of consciousness. The logic of the contents is sort of loosened up, but nonetheless, it is a conscious state, just not quite like the conscious state we're having right now, which includes not only a proper mind with logical constraints in the processing of the contents and a self, but also wakefulness.
Now, is consciousness the same or different from a sense of self?
The consciousness, to me, and that is the kind of argument I make in Self Comes to Mind, is what happens when to a regular process of mind, you add the process of self. So I would say that if you have mind plus a process of self, which can be simple or complex, then you have a conscious mind, and then you have consciousness.
So it's included, but not quite the, not quite
that's
the same.
That's correct. So I would say the components of normal consciousness, such as we have right now, you and I, are a wakefulness. We are awake, a state of mind, and then a state of mind within which there's this particularity that we call the self. And this self can be very simple, a sort of minimal self, the kind that we share with many animals, or it can be very, very complex, the kind that we have when we not only are aware of our experiences, we are experiencing pain or pleasure, feeling well or feeling hurting the throat like I do right now because I have laryngitis. But then in addition, you also sense that there is a me in you. In other words, I have a sense of my identity, and because you are actually interviewing me on a particular situation, which is the coming out of my new book, I have a sense of my identity because of that. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't think of it. But right now, I'm here as not just a visitor, but as a visitor who happens to be an author and a scientist and a neurologist and so forth.
Now, you did say something in there which leads to my next question. It's so last millennium to think we humans are the only one with consciousness and all these wonderful things.
Very last millennium.
Very last millennium. We don't believe that anymore.
We don't believe that anymore. Well, lots of people do, I have to say, but I don't. And I think that a lot of neuroscientists and many other folks who have thought about the problem don't believe that. In fact, even if you don't know anything about cognitive science or neuroscience, if you have observed animals, you have to have a sense, a very strong suspicion that they are mindful and conscious the same way we are. Of course, they don't need to have the same refinement of mind and consciousness that we do. It would be very strange if they would. But they share those same kinds of process. And that's the reason why we can so easily identify with them. That's the reason why we can look at animal behavior and feel that it relates to us, because it does it does have this familiarity. It has this ring of truth in terms of human behavior, and that's of course the fact that they have a mind, that they are operating in relation to mental representations, and they are also aware that they have them. They are having experiences, and they are aware that they have those experiences.
Hold on 1 second. I have to make sure I turn my phone off. Because it's one thing if you didn't turn it off, but if I didn't turn it off, I would be shot.
That would be... No,
and
no.
I did. That's good.
And I did too.
Very good. We're in good shape here.
You know why we did?
Why?
You know why we turned our phones off? We did it non-consciously. That's something that is interesting for your interview. Here we are talking about consciousness and how obviously important it is. But at the same time, we very often forget that we have this vast non-conscious processing capacity that in fact runs a lot of our routines. Now, you and I have been in situations like this. You do it all the time. I do it enough to know that you ought to turn off the cell phone, which you do when you go on an airplane or into a theater. And we did it without thinking that we were doing. In other words, we did not deliberate that I am going to turn off the cell phone. Our autopilot did it. The same way that your autopilot or mine can let us drive home or walk home without looking at every landmark and deciding if you're going to turn left or right or whatever. Because you have learned a routine and you have mastered it almost like a skill. And that non-conscious skill is driving your behavior.
Now, you see this as part of the evolutionary process, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's last millennium to think only humans have a sense of self and a consciousness, certainly at the level of language, which has been developed by humans, which I look at as technology, that language and other effects, that does have an influence on this, does it not?
Yes. And, you know, when I think of consciousness, and especially about the process of self, I think of three levels of self. One very simple, the proto-self, another a little bit more complicated, which has to do with the here and now, which is the core self, and another that is far more complex, that is the autobiographical self. We humans have all three. And many animals do as well, although not quite as complex as ours. But this autobiographical self is the one that allows me and you to have a sense of our personal history and, of course, confers upon us special aspects of personhood and identity. So we have a sense of our history. We have a sense of certain landmark events, certain places, certain events that marked us, certain preferences. Now, all of that is what I call the autobiographical self. Now, it turns out that, of course, in animals that have an autobiographical self, language cannot possibly play a role because they don't have it. However, in humans, language plays a huge role in the autobiographical self and just expands it. So many of the aspects of my autobiography now exist in my mind, exist in my memory, for example, not just as nonverbal factual events, but as nonverbal factual events that have been translated into whatever language I'm speaking at the moment. So there's a verbal commentary that has been added onto it. And of course, language expands the power, the depth, the modes of analysis that the autobiographical self can reach. So you're quite right. Language is a very important aspect, but it's not a determinant aspect. So we don't have autobiographical selves because we have language. We have a larger scope autobiographical selves because we have language.
Now, in earlier work, you suggested that our decisions are not made without emotion. We mm-hmm. tend to think we have ourself and our feelings and emotion, and then we have this very logical part that's making decisions. But you've come to believe that our decisions are not without emotion.
That's correct. I think that the in fact, the majority of our normal decision-making has an emotional component, and that emotional component can be a positive one, can be very helpful, make the decision more efficient and quicker, and sometimes it can be a very bad one. You know, emotions can derail the decision-making process. But emotion plays a very big role, and of course, every time that you have an emotion, we certainly as human beings have the chance of having the feeling that corresponds to that emotion, and that is extremely important in the organization of behavior. Now, what is so interesting is that the same way that emotion and feeling are vital for the process of decision-making, they're also vital for the process of consciousness. In other words, you cannot generate even the first step of the conscious process, the self process, without having emotion and feeling. And in fact, there's even a level of feeling that even precedes all emotions, which is what I call, in Self Comes to Mind, the level of primordial feelings. That is what you have when you have the feeling that you're here, that you exist. You're literally having the feeling of being alive, being alive either in a state of pain or pleasure or somewhere in between. And that very unvarnished, unbalanced feeling is really serving notice that you exist. And that's the very first step of the self. That's what emerges at the level of the proto-self. And that is something that I believe we share with a huge number of other animals. And it's very important.
If I understand what you're saying now and in your book, any time you are conscious, wakefully conscious, you have a constant stream of these primordial feelings.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're there. And in fact, I would even go a little bit further. If you eradicate, because of disease, if you eradicate primordial feelings, I suspect that consciousness collapses. You know, it would be like going to a very tall building and sweeping out the first floor very rapidly, and the building would collapse. Because everything is built on that foundation. I think a better analogy would be to say that it would be pulling out the foundation of a building. Because you built from there. And at any moment, you and I have these primordial feelings, and then you have this sense of the here and now, and then this spectacular sense of autobiography, which goes all the way into our lived past, but can also make appeal to the plans that we have for the future, and therefore also address the future that has not happened yet, the anticipated future. So we have this bizarre state in which we have memories of the past and what I like to call memories of the future.
And it's really seeking to keep us all in equilibrium.
Absolutely. The entire system needs to be understood in the perspective of biology, because, of course, none of this would even exist. Nature would not have bothered with preserving minds and self and consciousness if it would not be very helpful for survival and ideally for survival with well-being. And that survival is achievable if you manage to maintain life regulation within the very narrow parameters that are compatible with the continuation of life. And I think you touched on a very, very central note. If you do not maintain life regulation within those parameters, that very narrow range, you're sliding into the possible process of disease or even death. And our organisms, our bodies, to put it in cruder terms, our bodies are organized so that we stay away from that brink. But it is a brink. You know, you have to watch it. And we watch it in part non-consciously, and then minds with consciousness add this extra dimension that allows for a greater watchfulness.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Antonio Damasio. He is the director of the University of Southern California's Brain and Creativity Institute. Besides his substantive research, you may know him from his many books, including Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain. He's here today with Self Comes to Mind, Constructing the Conscious Brain. Well, I don't believe I've ever read a book before where I could take each chapter and do a whole interview on. So maybe you have to keep coming back week after week after week.
As long as I cure my laryngitis, you can have me anytime you wish.
Perfect, perfect. And so I did have to make some choices. And one of the choices I made was that in one chapter of the book, you talk about how you and several colleagues conducted a scientific experiment using fMRI, that's the moving images of the brain. And I'd like to use the example of this study regarding admiration and compassion. Take us through, if you will, the hypothesis, the experiment, and what you learned so that people can get a perspective, not just it's so interesting what you did, but that's the arc of how we use this fMRI.
Very good. So I think that your listeners need to know that with the advances in neuroimaging, we now have two very distinct modalities of study available. One uses structural images. So you look at the anatomy of the brain, the living brain, as it is, and it produces marvelous pictures in two or three dimensions that look a lot like postmortem pictures, the kind of slices that you would obtain when you would study a brain after death. The other modality is called functional magnetic resonance or positron emission tomography, in which you capture, as you say, moving images. So what you capture is patterns of activity of certain regions of the brain or patterns of inactivity when the brain of that particular person is engaged in a task, like, for example, talking like we are, listening as you are, having a learning task, or having an emotion, or having a state of consciousness, or a state that is not conscious, like being asleep. So that is a wonderful tool, and in the proper hands, it can produce very beautiful results. Now, the study that you are referring to, Moira, is a study that we did regarding what we call social emotions. We're very interested in social emotions because they have naturally, in evolution, they have a moral content. So examples of emotions like that are compassion, admiration, pride, guilt, shame, embarrassment, contempt, and so forth. All of these emotions have an aspect that has to do with moral behavior. So, for example, if you have compassion for someone, you're going to engage in behaviors that are going to be positive for the person that you are compassionate about, and that are indirectly going to be positive to the group that you belong to. If you have admiration for somebody's behavior, you're going to be rewarding and contributing to the reward of the behavior of the person that just did something admirable, which means that you are interfering positively in what a group, a society, and individuals think they ought to do. So that mixture of that appearance of moral elements comes exactly through the way in which the emotion will interfere in the life of the person who is the target of the emotion. So, long preamble to say that in this particular experiment, we wanted to contrast two kinds of admiration with two kinds of compassion. So, on the one hand, we had a situation in which you can be compassionate for somebody who has just had a terrible physical predicament. Somebody slipped in the ice, broke a bone. You have compassion for physical pain, very immediate. But you can have compassion for somebody who did not have an accident visibly, but who is in deep mental pain because of the loss of some loved one. That's a different kind of compassion. One is for the physical exterior, the other is for the internal mental state. By the same token, we wanted to contrast two kinds of admiration. One for a skill, you know, the virtuosity of, say, a great musician. And the other, admiration for an act of great valor and generosity. Somebody who has just saved the life of somebody else, a hero, a great philanthropist, and so forth. And we were convinced that because in two of these conditions you had an immediate physicality about it, and in two of these conditions, the two others, we had an internal state, we would find different responses in the brain. And that's exactly what happened.
Both compassion, both admiration, but they were in two different places in the brain.
There were certain things that were shared. And there were certain parts of the brain that were equally engaged. But then there were parts of the brain that were more engaged in the physical aspect than in the mental aspect. And that was something that we thought might happen, and in fact did happen. Something else that we predicted, and that turned out to be correct as well, had to do with time. Considering that compassion for physical pain is not strictly human. I mean, you can have a chimpanzee or a dog show compassion for another dog or another chimpanzee or even another species that has just hurt himself. So we thought, well, this must be evolutionarily older and very adaptive, because it would be good for the group if there would be animals that would mind the state, the physical state of other animals. So we thought, well, this is probably much, much older in evolutionary terms than having compassion, for example, for the fact that someone lost a husband or a wife.
Something you couldn't see, you couldn't observe.
Exactly. Why would the chimpanzee care if another chimpanzee is in deep depression, assuming that the chimpanzee would have that deep depression? So we thought that that would take longer. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. So the more physical the condition, the faster the brain reacts to it and organizes the process. The more mental the condition, the more the brain needs to look at the problem, digest the problem, bring back information that makes it sense what you're really dealing with. And that takes longer. You know, whenever you have to process material mentally, that takes brain time. You know, it's not something that is done as quickly.
As I recall, you did make one hypothesis that didn't pan out.
There was one hypothesis that we did not want to have turn out positively, and that was the following. Could it be that because social emotions are very often thought of as being acquired in the culture, something that is sort of a veneer that is layered onto the mind, therefore to the brain, as, say, a child is growing. Could it be that these emotions, because they're social and so complex, would not engage the body, and especially the parts of the brain that have to do with the body in the same way? Because we know that, for example, if we have fear, which is a very basic, one of the most fundamental emotions, we know that the parts of the brain that deal with the body are very, very heavily engaged. So could it be that when you're dealing with something as lofty as admiration, that you don't do that? And that's definitely not the case. So it doesn't make any difference whether it is admiration for heroism or fear. You are still going to engage your body. It's one way of putting it is that all of these emotions are related to the flesh, and they're being felt in the flesh.
That's one of the aspects that comes to me again and again reading your book, and that your emotions are not all in your brain. They're not part of just a state of an isolated brain out here. Your brain is interrelated with your entire body. And it's
Absolutely.
All of that together that enables the consciousness.
Right. And you know, again, that is so critical, and it's something that is so often forgotten, is that you don't have a brain to write poetry or to write the music of Mozart or the theater of Shakespeare. That's not why the brain was invented by nature. We have a brain because we want to have better regulation of our bodies, of our organisms. So it would stand to reason that the mind and the processes of self, and certainly the processes of our emotions, would be very much related to the state of the body. This is not, you know, you cannot conceive of the brain pulled out from the body and put inside a bucket and still produce mind and behavior. It will not. It would not. We have a brain that is in place. We have a brain that is totally wired to the body and is wired from the body. There is a constant, heavily looped interaction with the body.
There is no magical separateness to your consciousness.
Definitely not. And I think that the idea that body and brain have a sort of very sharp border, a frontier with passports and everything, is very problematic. I don't think it exists. I think body and brain are far closer physiologically than they appear. And one thing that I call attention to in this new book is the fact that let's not forget that brain cells, neurons, are living cells like the rest of the cells in our bodies. They're special. They have a very particular range of tricks that they do. And, of course, they permit the creation of maps and therefore images, and they therefore allow for the possibility of cells, and that's very beautiful. They also permit the control of muscles to generate action. But that doesn't mean that they are, in essence, a different quantity as far as living is concerned. They are, brains are made of cells just like hearts or guts or the skin is made of cells. They're all individual little organisms with their own little genomes, with birth, a life cycle, and eventually death. So all of these elements in our bodies are faced technically with the same problem, which is the problem of how to regulate themselves so that they can survive for as long as the genes allow them to.
Let's go back now to the primordial feelings that we're constantly having, and then that builds up into all kinds of feelings that we would recognize given the full context of our lives and experience and situation. And enter now alcohol, drugs, mm-hmm. sex, whatever is your preferred yeah. self-medicating thing that you do, work, yeah. you name it. You make a point of saying that if it's addiction, from a brain standpoint, you can't just say no.
Right.
Why doesn't that work?
It's a complicated story. If it would be simple, of course, there would be no drug addiction and no social problem and no individual drama. So what you have is that I think that the tendency towards self-medication, which is universal and applies to everyone, has to do with the fact that we, as conscious individuals, can become keenly aware of suffering. We can become keenly aware of the fact that we have pain or that we don't have the well-being that, say, we once had and that we would like to return to. And there are all sorts of circumstances that can lead to that, whether it is a physical disease or whether it is a social situation in which you feel, say, ostracized and you're off balance. The way I look at all those circumstances is circumstances of loss of homeostasis. So instead of being in the good range of homeostasis, where you're neither highly pleasured.
Everything's just fine.
Yeah, everything's just fine. You're no longer there. You're going towards the pain direction, and that's not a good thing because that's already sending signals that a correction is needed. And I think that the drama of the addict is that there's a discovery that a certain substance, whether it is alcohol or some other, will suddenly bring back the balance that was lost. And that bringing back is, of course, pleasurable, and it's something enjoyable, and for a certain period of time, the pain is gone. Now, the problem is that that substance in itself, first of all, does not last very long in terms of its positive effect, but then has, for reasons that have to do with our physiology, is going to have a range of negative effects that is going to bring down your health. And furthermore, because of the social conditions in which these drugs operate, is going to bring its own host of social problems. So what the addict is doing is, in the effort to return to normalcy, the addict is actually adding problems at the level of health and at the level of society. So that's when the spiraling down begins. And it's, of course, very unfortunate. But once you have those hooks in your system, it is completely senseless to say, well, you know, just get out of it. You know, just, you know, shape up and don't do it. That does not seem to be so easy to do. And if it were easy to do, of course, more people would do it, and they don't. So something is very powerful there. And in a way, some of these drugs literally hijack the system. And when they hijack the system, they start commanding it in a different way. And that's why you need to look at the situation as, in fact, a medical situation that needs all sorts of help, some of which is at the very basic medical drug level, and some of which obviously has to do with the social pathology that has been created about it.
In fact, you say what you need is a strong, positive counterpunch.
That's correct. Thank you for noticing that. I think that's a very good idea. Well, I shouldn't say this because
it's your
it's
idea. we'll go with it.
You know, it's interesting. When people have a negative emotion, it's often said, well, just don't do it. You know, counter it, suppress it. I always go back to the idea of a very wonderful thinker that I very much admire, and that is Spinoza. And Spinoza says something, I think, quite practical, and that is that you can only counter a negative emotion by having a positive emotion that is stronger than the negative emotion. So the idea is not to go to reason and say, don't. You know, this categorical imperative that would say, don't do it, get off that particular line of behavior. The trick is to find something that will be immensely positive and more powerful than the thing that you're trying to counter. Now, of course, this is all easier said than done. It looks beautiful as a conceptual frame, and I think it is a correct conceptual frame. The question is, where are you going to find that thing that is positive and is more powerful? That's the trick.
Now, buried in the notes section of your book, in tiny print, I had to get up my really strong glasses, you talk about a conversation you had with Francis Crick, who was on this show 15 years ago, sitting in this very room, with his book, Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. And in your conversation with Dr. Crick, you referred to British psychologist Stuart Sutherland, who defined love as a form of mental illness not yet recognized by any of the standard diagnostic manuals.
Yes. Now, it was quite hilarious.
You don't specifically take love on in the book. Is love a feeling, an emotion? What is love?
Well, it's a state. It's a state of mind that is highly emotional and feelingful. I don't know if I would call it a specific emotion. No, I think because there's so many different emotions that can be mixed in love, and it depends on the stage of love that you are. It depends, first of all, if it is you're talking about romantic love or about something loftier, if that's possible, that would be the love of humanity or something like that. So it is a complex emotional state. That's as far as I would go. But I think that the Stuart Sutherland definition is pretty funny, and I remember that Francis and I had a wonderful time with it. And that's the time in which he was advising me quite strongly about the dangers of talking about consciousness. And I tell you, he was right. He was right because, you know, there used to be the joke in the field of neuroscience, and even to some degree in philosophy, that you should never tackle the subject of consciousness before you would get tenure, because you would never get tenure otherwise, because it is so controversial and people get so irate about definitions and of what is conscious, what is not conscious, and they're more likely to crucify you than not. I don't think it is possible to have, say, an article or a book on consciousness and to have everybody say, my God, isn't this beautiful and correct? Now, lots of people are going to like it, and lots of people are going to say, this is complete trash, get it out of the way. So I think that's what Francis was talking about. And by the way, I miss him very much. It was, wonderful conversations that we used to have.
Well, I remember he came here quite late in the afternoon after a day of interviews where everyone wanted to talk to him. Who wants to talk to Francis Crick of famous, Watson and Crick fame, of course. And, of course, he's coming in talking about the scientific search for the soul. Of course, by the time he'd gotten here, he had been, God knows how many interviews he had done and what they had asked him. And so I meant to ask him, because he had said very clearly in the book that that everything could not yet be explained.
Right.
And so I asked him to characterize, what was missing. And he got very angry and he said, well, if I knew what was missing, I would have put it in the book.
So, that sounds like him.
Sounds like him, yeah. Doesn't it? Well, yeah. It was a delightful interview, and I can assure you that he got tenure. So he already had tenure when he started to work on it.
By the way, it was marvelous, and he could be extremely warm and kind to people in general, and especially to scientists. He could get extremely testy and difficult.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Now let's wrap up here by going back in time with humans themselves. Once I realized that all decisions had an emotional component. I mean, it's not a far leap to say, well, actually, then all your actions that you do consciously have to have an emotional component. And you were mentioning in the book, for instance, the cave paintings some 32,000 years ago in Chavez, 17,000 years ago in Lascaux. And we've always looked at these paintings. We've talked about them. Archaeologists have come in, all kinds of people have come in to talk about these things. And yet, no one has ever looked at it in terms of an emotional component. And yet, these people were human.
Absolutely. They were human. They were very emotional. And, I mean, look, when you look at the themes of these paintings, they are about, I don't know if it's about romantic love. Certainly, many of them are about sex. And they are about very practical things, hunting and getting food. Guess what? Food and sex are not that unimportant for running our lives. And there is an element in them that has to do with the application of pigments and shapes that in all likelihood were creating pleasure in the viewers that must have been around, because it's hard to imagine that in these places you had the paintings and they were not seen by anybody. The artist was alone. Well, the artist probably was very much accompanied by others. Another element that is very much emotive is the fact that, again, in all likelihood, many of these paintings were in places not of daily living. They were not the usual dwelling. They were in places of assembly, possibly in places of worship already. It's quite possible, and of course, what is more emotional than worship and assembly for certain purposes, such as, for example, organizing a food gathering or organizing war against another group. Something that is intriguing as well, which I point out in the book, is that although we do not have the proof positive of this, there might have been music being made, being played in those same places. And then there's something just as important, which is drumming. Obviously a musical, highly rhythmic, highly organizational activity, which one has a little bit of evidence for from the way certain surfaces seem to have been beaten up by the beating of a drum-like activity. And finally, let's not forget that human beings have a born drum in their chests. So if you beat your chest, you have a drum available to you, and you can drum to your heart's content. You don't need to drag the darn thing around. It's just there. So I think that a lot of the life that was being lived in those caves, not regular day-to-day, but this form of assembly would have been highly enriched and probably driven by emotion.
Well, Antonio, thank you so much. You're welcome on Tech Nation anytime. Please come back and see us.
I will come back with great pleasure. Thank you, Myra.
More information about this interview is available on the web at technation.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of Tech Nation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Tech Nation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.